Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be back in conversation today with Pamela Tagji, the director of Jacob's Pillow, an international dance festival, professional school, and archive located in the Berkshires in Weston, Massachusetts, celebrating its 87th consecutive summer. Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival 2019 continues with world premieres, new commissions, international artists, anniversary celebrations, pillow exclusive engagements, and work developed at the Pillow Lab. Jacob's Pillow is home to the longest running dance festival in the United States, a National Historic Landmark, a National Medal of Arts recipient, and has steadily expanded its reach as a year-round center for dance research and development. You can find out more at jacobspillow.org. Welcome, Pamela Tagji.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I have to tell you, you have sitting with you here today one big fan for your work. Not only the quality of the performances at Jacob's Pillow, which we're all aware of, but also for your ability to keep it all going. It's not easy. You got to find the money, as we know here at WAMC and so many other places. And you are a genius at that. And you deserve a great deal of credit from all of us. I've always thought, not prolonging this, that Jacob's Pillow, along with Tanglewood, are two of the most important places, the vortexes of the Berkshires. And it's remarkable that Jacob's Pillow is the place. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate it.
So let's start by reminding everybody about your background.
Okay, well, I've now been at Jacob's Pillow for 3 years. I think you had me on within my second month, I remember. So yes, I've been there for 3 years. Before that, I was at Wesleyan University for almost 17 years as the director of the Center for the Arts. It was a multidisciplinary arts center that I ran there. But dance was the anchor. It's the thing that the students took to, that the community took to, and that became my big love. And so when this job at Jacob's Pillow opened up, it was wonderful.
Now, you have just given me the next round of questioning, which is so fascinating to me. You know, this classical music, there's a debate as to whether it's failing or whether it's getting better. But dance, there's something about dance that is unique as an art form, which makes people passionate about it. Explain that.
So that's a great question. I honestly believe that it's because we communicate. If you think of what we're like when we're children, we use our whole body to experience the world, right? We use all of our senses. We're running around. We're experiencing everything. And then as we get older, our knowledge getting seems to focus itself in our head and not in our bodies anymore. And I do think that when we see dance, we connect with a way of experiencing the world that is unlike any other. It connects us to ourselves, to each other, and people call it a universal language. I heard someone over the weekend say it's not a language because language has grammar. It's a form of communication, and we tap into that communication, and we can't help but be deeply connected to it.
Is there a difference between the way in which men and women approach dance?
I don't think so. I think that in sort of classical ballet, let's say there were roles that men have, and there still are roles that men and women have, but even that, those boundaries are being broken in really exciting ways. And in terms of experiencing dance, I'm amazed. You know how in audience development efforts, you call certain people initiators? They're the people who arrange the social engagements for their friends. I'm amazed at how many men are the initiators for going out to see something at Jacob's Pillow. That we have a lot of men who are passionate about engagement.
How do you know
engagement.
That?
Because you know who orders the tickets. So you'll have a big ticket order for 10 people under a man's name as opposed to under a woman's name, let's say.
Huh.
Or if you don't know that person's gender, again, we have to be knowledgeable that there's certain people who don't classify themselves that way.
So how does it start? Does it start that a young person takes ballet lessons or takes dance lessons and that's what creates this passion?
You know, first of all, I'll never forget my first member event at the Pillow when our members were in the house. I was standing on the Ted Shawn Theater stage and I said, raise your hand if you've been coming to the Pillow for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And everyone couldn't believe when I stopped at 40 and they said, keep going. Because there was 50 years, 60 years. And I asked people, how did you get introduced to dance? So many of them were introduced during camp. You know, we have so many camps in Western Massachusetts. And so what you need is an introduction as a child. That's very important. And, you know, as we know, it's so important to integrate the arts in the schools because of how you engage as you grow older. If you build that habit as a young person, you'll keep it up. So that's often how people get introduced, but also people dance themselves. It's such a source of pleasure, and I think people love to be in settings where they see our human capacity to dance. And so who knows where it starts, but I would say that most of our audiences were introduced at a very young age.
I know I'm a provocateur, but let me ask you whether or not you think men or women play a more important role in dance.
In what way?
Well, you know, when I'm at Czechoslovakia and I'm watching a phenomenal female dancer with a male, it almost seems to me that the female plays much more of a role in the dynamic of the dance than the man does. Is that just my view of it?
I think that's your lens, Alan, I have to say, because what I'm so amazed by increasingly is we just had a week of thinking about partnering in dance.
Interesting.
And increasingly, you will see male-male duets, female-female duets. You'll see female-male duets where the female is doing all of the lifts that the male does.
The female is lifting the male.
Exactly. And so we are really blurring those lines in very exciting ways.
Is that progressive now, Pam, or is it something that is institutional? In other words, I asked the question, which of the two roles? And you answered, well, we're beginning to go see a different kind of progress, mm-hmm. which would seem to me to indicate, not that I want to have a fight with you, mm-hmm. but that traditionally it was the male who sort of was the lifter and the person who did less than the female, who did incredible things.
Absolutely. In the traditional roles, particularly of ballet, that is still true. The female is often the focus of attention. And if you think of our founder, Ted Shawn, he founded the men dancers because he believed that males could be virtuosic, had their own vocabulary separate from women. So, yes, this all started 87 years ago with Ted Shawn, in fact.
Tell us a little bit more about him.
Oh, an amazing pioneer of American modern dance. His company was Dennis Shawn. He and Ruth St. Denis really believed that dance was more than the classical vocabulary that people had come to see. So they researched dances from around the world. They performed dances barefoot, grounded in the floor, in ways that was revolutionary at the time. And this is, you know, we're talking about the 1910s and 20s, traveling around. And what I loved about them was they were the original sort of bus and truck dance company. They would go to little town halls in small rural America and perform dance and really broadened people's appreciation and understanding of what dance could be.
I missed the reference to bus and truck. What does that mean?
So you have bus and truck and theater tours. So that just means that, you know, instead of flying on planes, you go to town by town in a bus. Your scenery's in the truck. Your cast is in the bus. So that's that reference. But what I loved was how democratic they were. They went everywhere. And so Shawn, at a certain point, decided that he wanted to experiment with dancing only with males. And so he actually bought this farm in Beckett, which was called Jacob's Pillow at the time, the
Why?
Carter family. Well, Beckett is located right off of Route 20, which was the road that went from Albany to Boston, and that was called Jacob's Ladder Road. And the Carter family found this big boulder on their property, and they said, oh, that must have been Jacob's Pillow. That's where
That's
he
great.
Must have dreamed of heaven. And so when Shawn came to look for a place where he could have a place where people could make work, grow their own food, have cabins, etc., he bought this farm. And so he recruited his first dancers from Springfield College. They were athletes. And he could see their capacity for movement in their athletic work. And he taught them his modern dance vocabulary.
In fact, there have been movies, there's at least one movie I remember about the guy who gets the football players to do
yes.
dance.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. There's a lot on Shawn. His autobiography is fascinating. And for anyone who loves The Pillow, you should really read his autobiography. It's just great.
So how come he gets all the credit and Ruth St. Denis doesn't?
Well, she does. He's the one who, you know, he was the one who primarily created Jacob's Pillow, so he gets our credit. He is our founder. But she visited regularly. She was his wife. She had her career. She was continuing to travel around. But annually and regularly, of course, came to be with Sean in Beckett. And so, but we acknowledge him as our founder.
Now, the great Marge Champion,
yes,
who's played such an important part in all of this, is so important. And I often think of my conversations with her, and one of them was she didn't like the fact that women dancers had to get up on their toes.
Oh, yes. I never heard that. That's so funny.
Maybe that's my imagination, but that's the way I remember it. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. No, she's amazing. She's going to be 100.
Yes,
and I visited her in Los Angeles. She's an amazing woman.
You know, you really have your hand on the pulse of what young dancers are doing. You know how to raise money around dance. You know all of that stuff. That's what makes you a genius in my mind. So my question to you is, what's popular, what's not?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think what's wonderful is that Jacob's Pillow has always been committed to representing dance in its widest range, its widest breadth. So we will always have ballet companies featured in the festival because it's such an important international form. But we will also be presenting what's next in dance. And that means dance that is grounded in different social dance forms, different traditional dance forms from different cultural traditions. And what I love is that typically when people come to the Pillow, often they're drawn by ballet because that's what they know. And then because they love the experience, they start to venture into other forms. I think that the vocabularies in modern dance or postmodern dance are exploding. And what's exciting is that no week at the Pillow is like any other week because of it.
And so you have tap dance or
yes,
you have hip hop. Is there any place you absolutely say to your staff, no, I'm not going there?
No, far be it for me to say that, because Jacob's Pillow has prided itself on the broadest definition. So no, uh-uh.
Hey, Pam Teji, how do you get money? A lot of people say, well, she's a genius because look at the people she gets to come and all of that. But on the other hand, if you don't have the money, you can't have it. You can't do it.
Right. So first of all, I have an astonishing board of trustees who has been so supportive of our strategic plan, which is Vision 22. That's our vision for the year 2022. And it's their charge to introduce new people to the Pillow who can give. Our largest segment of supporters are our individual donors. We've gotten some fantastic foundation support for two things. First, the investment that we've made in the Pillow Lab, which is our year-round center for research and development in dance. We provide residencies for artists to create new works. And foundations are very excited about assisting the Pillow and assisting the field.
Let me stop you there and say, the Tanglewood, your co-genius production company, is moving more and more to the Berkshires for year-round.
Yes.
Mean, certainly they're a Boston institution. Mm-hmm. But they will be there. Is that true of Jacob's Pillow also?
Oh, yes. We started this in 2017. We started this
first.
A while ago. Yes, exactly. No, I mean, we have 36 buildings, 220 acres. To make this space available to artists as a residency site is truly a gift. Right now in New York, to find a space to rehearse a new work is next to impossible, to get a piece of time that's even like 4 hours.
Well, what about all the cold and the freezing and the snow?
It doesn't matter because they live. They have a beautiful farmhouse that they live in. They walk up the hill in the snow. It has heat. And as long as they get to the grocery store before the snow hits, you know, they've got their food. They spend their day. They go back, they cook dinner, and they can go back to the studio after dinner. And that 24/7 immersion, they say they can get in 1 week, get what they would get done in 6 months in New York.
Pam Teji, how long is that going on? In other words, how many people actually show up to do that kind of in-depth rehearsal and creation?
So this starts right when the festival ends. It runs from September through May. And this past year, we had 12 different dance companies,
wow,
including two international companies, come with, you know, some come as few as 3 dancers. One brought a company of 15.
And do you feed them?
They feed themselves. You know, they have a kitchen in their farmhouse. And
yes,
so they receive a stipend, which is very important to me. Dancers have to often, they have
sure,
other jobs. So we have to pay the choreographer so that they can pay their dancers. The other thing we do is we pay for an outside eye, a dramaturg and an editor to come in and give them feedback. And what I love about this program is we do a private showing at the end of each residency. And members of our college partnership program come.
What's that?
That is, so think about it. We run a festival that's in the summer. Our next audience are our college students. How are we going to access them? So what we decided to do was invite dance faculty members from all of the many colleges that you know are, surround the pillow, to embed these residency showings in their syllabi and invite their students. So the faculty and students come, and they end up giving feedback to the artist about the work in progress.
Now, can you, Pam Tachi, can you be specific about which colleges you've invited?
Yes. So some of the colleges that attend often are Williams, UMass Amherst, Smith, Hampshire College, Springfield College. We've had Tufts. Yeah, so that just gives you an example of some of the colleges that we have. And it's wonderful because members who give $500 and up are also invited to these private showings. So you have this fabulous dialogue. Our members are typically an older generation alongside this next generation. And how they perceive the same work of art is absolutely fascinating.
You know, that's so interesting. We've been privileged, Roselle and I, to be at your openings over the years. And frankly, when you go to some cultural institutions in the Berkshires, you only see gray. But I have to say, I turned around to Roselle and said, wow, there's an awful lot of brown here and hair and black hair and blonde hair here.
Yes, it's great. We have really targeted initiatives. One of them is an under 35 ticket price so that people can come for just $25. And then they have a, you know, often come to our cast party on Saturday nights, which is a great dance party. We have also a Berkshire resident rate to be able to have year-round residents come to the festival. That's $25 as well, subject to availability. And we've had hundreds of Berkshire residents take advantage
so
of that rate.
So if you're a Berkshire resident, just to be clear, as a Berkshire resident, I ask this question, you can take advantage of a reduced rate because you live in Berkshire County.
That's right. You show your license and that has, you know, your residence. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So Pam Tachi, what annoys you?
What annoys me? Oh, my. The first thing that leapt into my head was weather sometimes is challenging at the pillow. So we have a magnificent company that we brought from Los Angeles to perform on Inside Out, and it's a rainy performance, so we have to move it inside.
So that annoys you.
That does annoy me. But we have a beautiful studio now. We used to bring people into the Rue St. Denis, which was only 70 people. Now we have the most beautiful Perlis Family Studio, which seats 200, and that's great. What annoys me is people who think they know what Jacob's Pillow is because of some old perception. And what I mean is that we're perhaps, you know, on top of the mountain and not concerned about everybody. And all of our work to take dance off the mountain into Berkshire County, all of our cultural partners who've worked with us to make sure that we have pop-up performances at the Clark, at Mass Mocha, you know, we are all working to have dance be everywhere. And we are for everyone. We want everyone to belong at Jacob's Pillow.
Which, of course, leads us into the next very sensitive question. Mm-hmm. You were involved in an incident that just occurred that had to do with something that happened at the pillow. And I wanted to know how that all came about, whether you could describe this as a case study.
So I had a patron to our gala 10 days after the gala give me a call and say, I need to speak with you. And she's someone I care about. And so I said, absolutely. And she told me the story of her experience at our institution, which was so painful to me to hear this woman who is a mother, she's, you know, an active member of our community, be treated in the way that she was by a select group of our patrons.
No, she's an African-American.
She is a biracial person. And so do you want me to tell you what happened? Okay. So she came to the gala, she sat in the theater, and a white couple sat behind her. And the male of the male-female couple reached out and felt her hair. And she froze. She didn't turn around. And she said to me, this isn't the first time that someone has felt my hair. I've never felt it from behind that way. Usually people just reach out when we're talking and say, oh, you have great hair. She has tightly coiled hair that's in a sort of ponytail and a halo around her head. It's beautiful. And so she got up and she left the theater. She ran into one of our staff members. She talked with her for a bit and decided to go back and see the performance. After the performance, she went to her, we assigned people tables to sit at for the dinner portion of the evening. She sat down at a table. She chatted with the people at the table. And as the night wore on, one of the women at the table said to her, basically just said, "What are you?" And she said, what do you mean? And she said, "What are you? Are you black?" And she said to me, when she told me the story, if the person had said, "Who are you? Where are you from?" But she just began with, "What are you?" And that led to a whole series of questions. What did you decide to marry, a black or a white? What do your kids think about this? And these really objectifying questions that made her extremely uncomfortable. And she was really torn. She said, "I'm a guest here at Jacob's Pillow. I don't want to make a scene." And so she got through the evening. Someone else at the table volunteered, as if to make her feel good, "My husband was Irish, and he's descended from indentured servants too." And it's people not thinking. It's people who are not taking a minute to think about how other people might feel when they say certain things. This is hugely painful. And I heard this story and I thought, I can't be silent. To be silent is to normalize this behavior, to ignore it. And at this time in our history, we have to be accountable for our actions and our behavior. And I don't have the answers. And I decided to write an op-ed because I want to ask our community, what should we do?
So just stop for a second.
Yeah.
Pam Taji, you wrote an op-ed which raised an awful lot of eyebrows in the Berkshires, in the Berkshire Eagle.
I did, yes. I'd never written an op-ed before.
Okay.
And it was actually my deputy director who a couple of weeks earlier had said, "You know, you should consider writing an op-ed. You have a lot of ideas about community engagement, about how artists should be supported, et cetera." And when I heard this story, I thought, this is how I'm going to let people know that this behavior isn't acceptable and that we all have to think about how to be in this world. But I wanted to do it from a place of humility, in that I don't know the answers, but I wanted to draw attention to this woman's story because I wanted that story to be told.
So Pam, tell me about your own, because it's a remarkable story. I mean, you know, you don't see many heads of institutions calling attention to its own problem the way that you did. Very courageous. So what is it about you, if you can, that looking back into your life, that makes you think that this is so important? Is that an unfair question?
No, it's a very good question, but let me just say that I'm a little self-conscious as a white woman of privilege to be having this conversation about my life. I've had a very privileged life. I've been able to operate in this world as a white person with all of the privilege that's accorded to that. So that said, the first thing I think about is one of my mentors, Liz Lerman, who's a Jacob's Pillow Dance Award winner, who talks about turning discomfort into inquiry. Let's turn what we're not comfortable with into a question. Let's ask ourselves why we're not comfortable with this. And to me, this was a moment where I had to sort of sit with myself and say, what is making me so furious? Well, what's making me furious right now is the racist rhetoric that we have in this country coming from our leadership. And perhaps in that moment when I heard that story, another sort of refrain that I will say has governed my career is to act locally. When in doubt, look to your family, look to your friends, look to places where you can make a difference. And to tell you the truth, I thought I was publishing an op-ed in the Berkshire Eagle. It didn't even occur to me that this would be in social media and be shared. It really didn't. I was really looking at a way to reach our community, which is largely from Berkshire County, although, you know, 40% of the people who come to the Pillow every year are tourists. They're first timers. So I thought that would be a way to reach my community and open up a dialogue. And it really, the point of it was to start a dialogue and to have all of us own that we watch this happen every day. And the other thing that was clear to me is the staff members of color at Jacob's Pillow, they experience this very often from our patrons.
They do?
They do.
Which is a sort of insensitivity, is that the idea?
Yes, it's any number of, you know, the term is microaggressions, small gestures that are diminishing of people and make our staff uncomfortable. And they not only make the staff members of color uncomfortable, but our fellow, their fellow staff members who are not of color are similarly charged with observing behaviors of some of our patrons. Let me just say that I love our audience. There is no more passionate group of people about an institution than the Jacob's Pillow audience. And I am talking about a select group of people who don't have a self-awareness of the context in which they operate and speak sometimes.
So, Pam, one of the things I was surprised about was that it was controversial. What you did was controversial. There were at least a few letters to the paper which questioned the whole incident. Mm-hmm. I was astounded by that, but there they were. You know, did it ever happen? That kind of thing. What was your reaction?
You know, first of all, there were only, I think, two or three that were negative. The other, other letters were overwhelmingly positive. And I think, so what? I think it's okay to disagree. I think we have got to get to a point in our country where it's okay to have an opinion and disagree with the mainstream opinion and be able to express that. We can't shut down dialogue. And in fact, it was great that we had a couple of people who doubted it, who questioned it, because it made others say, no, I have to come forward because I want to support this idea of a conversation. And so that's how I felt about it.
So, not to get too far into the weeds, did you ever find out who it was who touched the hair?
I have an idea because, of course, we have seating charts and we know where she was sitting. But, you know, Alan, people exchange their tickets. Things can happen. I can't be 100% sure. It was 10 days after the gala that this story happened. I have an idea of who was sitting at that person's table. But that, to me, that wasn't the point. Yes, there was one letter who said, you know, Jacob's Pillow should ban the people who did this from the pillow. And I think that's, you know, I think if we see incidents like these in the moment, we are going to be talking with people. That is going to be a change at Jacob's Pillow. In other words, we have values.
Henceforth,
yes. If we have the opportunity to experience this as a staff member in the moment, we will be able to say to people, you know, what you just did is not appropriate and it's not in line with our pillow values and the kind of inclusive environment that we're trying to create here.
I have to say, because we have the panel in the morning on WAMC, we get some letters that would make your hair stand on edge.
You talk about them sometimes, Alan. I know I've heard about that. And I love the fact, actually, that you air them, that you read them.
Sure, because if you don't read them, people aren't aware that this kind of stuff goes on.
That's right.
Yet, you know, there is a sort of subliminal, unconscious, you may want to call it racism. Other people may call it something else. But I can just see somebody sitting there thinking, this is beautiful hair. I'm going to touch it.
I can tell you, Alan, no one's ever reached out and touched my hair without asking me.
Very good point. That's a very good point. I'm just trying to think of any possible defense that anybody who had done that would have been. And you're quite right, of course.
I think that's our tendency, is to try to excuse it. And
I wasn't trying to excuse it. I was trying to question it.
Yes, I understand that. There's a great book that I've just started at the recommendation of one of my staff people named White Fragility. And it really is about that if people don't really appreciate that racism exists, that even progressive, white, liberal people cannot help but have been conditioned and socialized in their life to have perceptions and act on them, that there is implicit bias. If we immediately say, oh, no, I was raised differently. Everyone's the same. I treat everyone the same. You actually have to question that. You have to understand that there are all sorts of ways that you can express your identities in ways that make others uncomfortable.
So, Pam, there's no question that this country is built on racism, built on slavery, built on Jim Crow after slavery, built on economic oppression right through. But there are many people who run cultural institutions who wouldn't have dared do what you just did.
I don't know, Alan. Maybe that's so.
It is so.
I know what I did, and that's all I can really think about. And I had a very supportive board who was behind me 100%.
You know, I have an African-American grandchild who I dearly love, and a son who is very sensitive to these issues. And people come and they pat him on the head. And he says, which is pretty close to what we're talking about, and he says, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that I get it. I get the fact that Americans aren't always conscious of the kinds of insult that comes with these actions.
That's right. That's right. And it's a lot about education. And in my mind, I felt like this story was a teachable moment for members of our community and for me.
Okay, so let's move on from this. Let me ask you this. Assuming that this story is what it is, and assuming that you have a sensitivity that says, I'm not going to let this pass, which is exactly what you did, which made you so unusual, how much of this kind of tension you've talked about here has occurred on the dance stage itself, in which issues of racism or sexism or discrimination have occurred? Do you think it shows in the way in which dance is performed?
I think that what I love about dance is that it is such a leveler of many different identities and traditions. And so what I love about dance is how inclusive it is. I mean, we have ballet companies, we have modern dance companies, postmodern dance companies that are very diverse, and they can all dance together and work together. They can represent for us on stage a microcosm of what we'd like our world to be.
So just for the sake of interpretation, you say very diverse. Diverse has a lot of different meanings.
That's
what do you
right.
mean in this case?
In this case, I mean racially diverse. We have yet to see a lot of companies that are thinking about able-bodied and disabled artists. There are a few of them. There's a wonderful focus in our field right now in celebrating physically integrated companies, which is what they call disabled dancers alongside able-bodied dancers. We've seen in certain companies age diversity on stage, which is really exciting. But what I'm saying is that doesn't mean that in the operations of those companies, they don't have similar issues in terms of transacting across difference that we all do. But somehow, when I see a company that celebrates racial and ethnic diversity on stage, I believe that we are reflecting, we're holding up a mirror and saying, this is how it could be. We could all move together and be able to transcend some boundaries. While at the same time, as you know, in dance, you can see that individual personality come through. And that's also a wonderful aspect of dance, that you can be moving as one, but you can still have that individual personality come through.
So much of this has to do with, as observers of dance, what the interpretation is. Now, look, we live in a world of misogyny, we live in a world of sexism, of discrimination, and all the rest of it. But different people watching dance are going to get different meanings out of it, right?
That's right. And it's so much about, you know, what did they bring into the theater that night? What's the argument they're
Absolutely.
Having with their partner? Any number of things that will affect how you experience a piece of the music that the dance is being done to, the dance itself. And I think that's the staying power of this form, is that you really can feel it individually and connect to it as an individual.
So, Pam Taji, let's go there. You just mentioned the word music, and I'm fascinated by that because, you know, you got a Jacob's Pillow, and sometimes the music is not that often is live.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, it's recorded. I wonder if you'd speak to that.
Well, first of all, it's been a value at Jacob's Pillow since our founding to have live music. And so anytime we can have an artist perform to live music, we actually have a higher level of compensation for companies that can bring live music into the mix. So we try to incentivize it. I'm thinking of, you know, the great Mark Morris, who has created his own ensemble that travels with him to present his work to a young tap artist, Caleb Teicher, who's 25 and performed with pianist and composer Conrad Tau. And he too is 25. And the two of them had a conversation on stage like I've never seen happen before. And that kind of dialogue between musician and dancer is, it's like nothing else. And it's as if there's a frequency that people are relating to that's one that is beyond what we as observers can really experience.
So in other places, you might have a dance company which has a Philharmonic Orchestra behind it.
That's right.
What's the largest you can remember having it?
I think the largest, I'd have to check with Norton Owen, our director of preservation, who is the king of all memories like this. But my memory is that we can take out the seats on house left and we can have an ensemble of about 8 to 10. So maybe that's the largest we've had.
How much does the fact that you've had so many other distinguished directors before you, I mean, is there any transition? Is there something that is handed on down from one director to another that you may be feeling?
Well, first of all, this is something I say to all of the dancers who come to the Pillow every week, is that you join everyone who came before you. There is that sense of, I'm going to say, sort of a spiritual lineage, that I inherit all of the relationships that artists have with Jacob's Pillow, so that when I become the director, I pick up those relationships where they left off. And that's the biggest legacy. So an artistic director like Liz Thompson, who introduced us to so many new companies that have later, we've become their artistic home. I inherit those relationships.
Interesting.
Ella Baff, all of the audience engagement work that she initiated that helped connect people to the art that they were seeing, from the pre-show talks to the post-show talks to Pillow Notes, all of that I inherit and I can build on.
How exhausting is what you do? I mean, you know, that leads to the next question about how long does somebody become the head of something like this? Do you see yourself here 25 years from now?
I can't really foresee 25 years. Right now, I'm focused on the fact that Festival 2020, next summer's festival, has to be done by November 1st. So I will be here as long as I can continue to fulfill my creative self, and as long as my community and my board wants to have me here. I feel very blessed to be in this position, to be stewarding such an extraordinary organization that has such incredible support. And what I love about the connections that we have is that everyone has their individual relationship to Jacob's Pillow, whether it's an artist like Anne Hutchinson Guest, a dancer who's just turned 100, who's danced at the Pillow many, many times and keeps coming as an audience member, to the great program, the darts program that Tanglewood runs that makes it possible for middle schoolers to come to different cultural organizations. That middle schooler who walks in, who, you know, I'm, you know, the next director will meet them when they're 40 and have, you know, a group of kids, and they're going to say, I came here as a middle schooler. It's your sense, I feel like I am a part of a continuum, and I am the steward of this institution at this period in its history, and it's my charge to help evolve it.
I have so many places I want to go here, but let me ask you this. We live in the age of Trump.
Yes.
And to so many of us, it's just a horrendous experience, which we just can't make heads or tails out of. It's just so awful for so many of us. I'm a political scientist. Does politics ever enter into the dance?
Absolutely. We tell many stories on stage, and some of them are quite political. And many would say that art just is political because it is a personal point of view. And you as an artist make a work a lot of times because you want to change something in the quote system. So we've had works that are responsive to what it was like to be gay in Harlem in the 1940s. We've had works that are in response to the refugee crisis. I'm thinking of work by Andrea Miller of Galim Dance called Boat, which is just completely gorgeous, poetic piece about boats of refugees crossing from Africa to Italy. We have works that resonate with LGBTQ rights. about a journey of an artist. I'm thinking of a particular solo of a choreographer. It's his story of his existing in this world as a gay man. So we often can reach people in very important ways because we aren't doing it with text. We're doing it through the body, through a visceral connection that's unlike any other.
You mentioned board several times during your time here. And of course, as an executive director or president, I know full well how important a board can be. What are the dimensions of that? Is it that they help you raise money? Is it that they support you so that when you know you're going to be in a tough spot, which you certainly put yourself into when you wrote your op-ed piece, you know, on racism. What can you tell us about the relationship between you and your board?
Well, first of all, I really felt like when I came 3 years ago, they were looking for a vision to evolve this historic, precious institution into, you know, the next decades. So they gave me the latitude to really have a listening tour, both in the community as well as across the field, to come up with a set of priorities. And we negotiated those priorities. I had a bunch of directions that I felt our institution could go in. And in a facilitated board retreat, we had an outside facilitator. We went through those priorities and we narrowed them down to three primary priorities for the next 5 years. And with that kind of anchor, everything else has come. The fundraising strategy has come. Okay, you have an idea that comes across your desk. It sounds like a great idea, but it actually doesn't forward the three goals of our plan.
And those three goals are?
They are strengthening the artistic core, which for me is making great work for the field and this whole residency program. How do we strengthen the field by creating new works of art, enhancing those works of art, and having convenings around issues that our field is facing? So number one is strengthening the artistic core. The second is boosting civic and community engagement, making the decision that we are citizens of Berkshire County. Our success is wrapped up in the success of Berkshire County. So what are the programs that we are going to do to enhance the quality of life here and be true partners and have reciprocal relationships with our community? That has given birth to an expansion of our public school program, pillow pop-ups that happen in Pittsfield monthly, our pop-ups that happen and partnerships that happen with area cultural institutions, the college partnership program. So that's two. The third is renewing campus facilities. We are an aging campus, and part of what we need to do over the next 5 years is really strengthen our facilities so that we can support the program. And the first thing the board did actually before I got to the pillow was make the decision that the most urgent need was to create a new home for the school, because the barn where the school was happening was pretty much falling down. So the Perlis Family Studio was created. It's a winterized space, so that became the home for the pillow lab in the off season. We could no longer use our intern cabins. We had a real crisis where we had 6 months before the festival was going to open, and our intern cabins were deemed uninhabitable.
Really?
And so we were able to, amazingly, with an incredible group of architects and construction managers and local people, make new cabins happen that are also winterized and become the home for artists.
Is there a role on your board for people who don't have money or give money?
We have a really interesting board giving policy. So there are dues that everyone needs to pay. And what we do is we take the total number of board members and we multiply that by the base dues, and that becomes the board goal for the year. So that if there are members of the board who can't achieve that goal, others give more, and in the end, we end up meeting our goal. That's how we accommodate having certain members of our board who we need, whose voices we need on the board, like artists. There were not artists on the board in the recent past at Jacob's Pillow until I came. I really wanted to have two artists on our board. And so those artists cannot meet the base dues. And so therefore, their dues are made up by others on the board.
Do you ever have anybody on your board who says, you should do this? In other words, you should do this kind of a performance, or I want to use my moxie, my muscle to get you, who, you know, are basically running the institution, to do what I want you to do. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't seen it, and it's because our chair is really clear in our new board member orientation. And in fact, at the first board meeting where he and I presided, he said, you know, Pam's area is the artistic leadership. You can give her suggestions, but we will never tell Pam who to program, who to admit to the school, you know, any number of things. They really understand that that is not their role. And I've never had a problem with that.
Yeah. And you can't envision a time when, for example, that we've all seen somebody comes to lean on you and says, my granddaughter is a great preliminary dancer. You should basically take her into your internship program, or you should do this with her, or give her a featured role.
Never, period. There will never be a moment where that will happen.
That's amazing, because it happens in many institutions, mm-hmm. and then that's when you're really measured in terms of your backbone, when you say,
and that's a slippery slope, right? You make an exception, then you know, it's not an option. And, you know, we have a director of the school, J.R. Glover, who's just terrific. She has her autonomy. Norton Owen is the curator of exhibitions. He has his autonomy.
Terrific.
The best. A national treasure is Norton Owen. And so we really address all of this in the new board member orientation and make sure that it's perfectly clear. And I know that I have a chair that would back me up if I ever was put in a position like that.
Do you ever feel like you're watching one of your performances and you'd like to get up there and join them? Were you a dancer?
I did study dance all the way through college, but I was never a professional. I love to dance in my kitchen when I'm doing the dishes. But no, I've never felt an impulse to run up on stage and join people. Although you can get certain beats inside you, and I'm definitely someone who sits in my seat. I actually worry about people sitting behind me because I move a lot when I watch dance. Mm-hmm. I do get
Nobody's
into
ever
it.
Tapped you on the shoulder and said, excuse me, Miss or Mrs. or Madam, would you please stop jerking yourself around?
No, never. So I have a certain self-consciousness about it. But no, Alan, I've never wanted to run up on stage.
Yeah. So the future is so dark right now with the Trump administration and the arts and making basically value judgments on who our population is, and the people who are thinkers often and academics often. So has there ever come a point where somebody has offered you money? I can only tell you without using the specific name that we were recently approached about taking money from a group that most people on the middle left would find abhorrent as a symbol of that. Do you have the guts to turn that down?
Well, I've not been faced with that before, so I would say that I certainly would hope that it would be the decision of the boards as well as mine. I would never make that decision on my own. Mm-hmm. We would have to decide about that. It also depends on sort of who the person is and what the circumstances are, but I can imagine that that could happen. I would like to believe that...
I'm sorry for stopping you, but the role of money in the arts is huge at this mm-hmm. stage of the mm-hmm. game. You've tied some of these very characters who I'm talking about with their names on theaters and, other places. And you say, is there ever a point at which people want the money more than they want to just preserve their dignity?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, if someone were to offer us money to do X, Y, and Z, that's what's wonderful about having a strategic plan that's board approved. You've got a blueprint, and you can say, actually, this doesn't fit with our mission and our goals right now. So thank you, but no thank you. And I think that's very important. Many organizations have gotten into big trouble in terms of, going where the wind goes, where's the funding train going, and we'll go in that direction. And I think you have to stay true to your mission.
Well, God bless you. And I hope that, you don't have to face that very thing.
What did you do?
I said no.
Uh-huh. Good for you.
I just said no.
Yeah.
I could have hidden. I could have gone to a different place. I just said no.
Yeah.
Because I thought we have to be true to ourselves.
Absolutely.
No matter what happens.
Yeah, you're a public radio after all.
We are, and if you don't stand for something, and I've said to the staff, you just never want to do anything that in any way compromises your integrity.
Absolutely.
And who you are. So as we reach into the future, we know that Jacob's Pillow is, such an important institution. Do you ever sit down with the other important institutions like Mark Volpe at Tanglewood and others and say, let's create something for Berkshire County that counts for something?
Well, there are a number of initiatives that are brewing. The one I'm most excited about is something a faculty member, Lisa Donovan at MCLA, is leading, which is to understand what each of us cultural institutions in the region are doing in the way of arts education so that we can comprehensively say, you come to Berkshire County, and in third grade, you'll have this from Massmoca. Fourth grade, you'll have this from Jacob's Pillow. And we can begin to attract people to come to this region as a place to raise their children because of the arts integration that exists in the public school system here. We all have public school programs, but none of us really knows what each other is doing.
Yeah.
So to me, that's the one that we're acting on right now. Lisa Donovan's gotten some foundation support to be able to do that. And I'm also in a wonderful cohort created by the Barr Foundation, which is Boston-based. They picked, I can't remember how many Massachusetts institutions. They awarded them grants based on excellence, relevance, and adaptive capacity, resilience. And Massmoca and The Pillow and I think others, you know, eventually will join the cohort. We're brought together. We talk about strategies. And I think that there's a lot of collaborative work that we can do here in Berkshire County. We have to find the time as leaders to carve out time and energy to devote to collaboration.
I can only say we are so lucky because really we do have the two best cultural institutions of their kind in the country, maybe the world, which is, the Boston Symphony and the Jacob's Pillow. And it is extraordinary. I feel blessed to live in Berkshire County because of you and because of Tanglewood and because of all the theaters. And I don't want to leave anybody out, but believe me, these two, to me, rise to the top. And Pam Taji, I want to thank you so much for giving us all this time today and for being who you are and having the guts you obviously have. So we've been talking with Pam Taji, the director of Jacob's Pillow Dance and International Dance Festival. I can say probably the International Dance Festival, professional school and archive located in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. You can find out more at jacobspillow.org. Pam, again, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.